Good afternoon, and welcome to week four. Week four? Yes, week four of Ezra and Nehemiah. And to those who are listening online, watching online, now I'm actually hearing from a few people. Usually, when we get the Tuesday afternoon classes, we tend to have some people who are also following online. But I think I've actually heard from more people regarding Ezra than with previous books. I think this is a book people want to learn. So, they're joining in. We are still in the first chapter, although I do think we're going to get to the end of the first chapter today. We read the decree of Cyrus last time. We talked about the different versions of it, or apparent different versions, at the end of Divrei Hayamim, the end of Chronicles, as well as here, as well as in chapter 6 of Ezra. We noted that it's possible to contend, and I think it's correct to contend, that chapter 6 of Ezra is giving you some of the text or some of the content that's further along in the decree. In other words, we're not getting the total decree right here in the beginning. We talked about Cyrus's use of the phrase the God of the heavens and the question of whether he believes in the God of the heavens, as he put it, or whether this is simply a political statement. We talked about the phrase that God had aroused his spirit and the idea of Ruach HaKodesh, of some kind of divine inspiration. And we talked about the call for the nations to support the Jewish return. Right? When Cyrus says, the neighbors, non-Jewish neighbors, it appears, should enable Jews to return. If the Jews can't afford it, then let the neighbors kick in and help with the Aliyah fund. And we noted, I think, towards the end, that this is something which mirrors what happens when the Jews leave Egypt. How we leave Egypt and we're also given gifts by our neighbors. So, a couple of reflections on this decree of Cyrus. First of all, imagine you're a Jew living back in the day, and this happens. Right? Cyrus issues this decree, which November 29th, 1947 is great, but has nothing on Cyrus. The United Nations not only saying, fine, you can go back, and we'll partition and whatever, but actually we're going to fund your return. And we're going to call upon your neighbors to fund your return to the land. What does this have to mean to Jews who hear this and they're living in exile? Living in what had been Babylon and is now part of the Persian Empire. Give me some sense of what you think that they would be feeling at this point.
Challenged.
It's a challenge.
Terrified.
Terrified because
it's such a change in status.
Huge change in status. Okay. Sorry, Janine?
Oh. I think you could compare it to today, where the opportunity is there, but the thought of leaving everything and going to Israel must be a,
Okay, opportunity but fear of leaving.
Susan? Even if you look at the Holocaust, where you have it good, and even though you see some bad signs coming at you, lots of people didn't want to leave. They trusted that they were safe.
So therefore they wouldn't go because they were confident where they were.
Yes.
Could be.
Just to leave.
Disbelief, like, can it possibly be?
From whence, yeah.
Okay. Susan? Yes. I'm making my way around. Susan?
Ulterior motives? What is their motives for letting them go? And what's happening back in Bucknell that they're able to go?
Well, that's a very modern sensibility, I think, because we've dealt with too many empires, and we've dealt with too many nations, and the suspicion that what they're calling a shower is actually a gas chamber is built into us, and that feeling of when it seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true. So I think that's a modern sensibility. I think that for them, knowing his history, knowing that Cyrus does the same thing for the Babylonians, right? I'm not sure that they're going to respond with that level of suspicion. Dahlia, you were going to say? Okay. All right.
Well, first of all, I would think either he's a benevolent king,
right.
And secondly, they should say, wow, Hashem must have made him do that. Well, we know it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is the agent of God. This is the fulfillment of the prophecies. And I think that has to be there for them. Meaning we saw, right, there are prophecies going back to the second chapter in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, the fourth chapter in Micha, the 14th chapter in Zechariah, about the nations coming to God in the future. V'naharu elav kol hagoyim, the nations are all going to stream to God, and they'll declare ki mitzion teitzei Torah, that the Torah comes forth from Zion. So, you know, they might view Cyrus in this way. This is the nations coming to appreciate God. Joyce. Right, this is our chance. We can now make Aliyah. I can afford it because now my neighbors are going to pay for it. A possibility. Lori.
I'm looking at it quite differently. I think the land was somewhat barren, occupied by other people, and there was a great reluctance to go to 43,000.
Oh,
there were so many
don't tell them that. Spoiler. Sorry. Okay.
Some of us have read the book.
Some of us have read the book, but that's the key. Some of us, like 42,000 of us. But Laurie makes the point that there are huge challenges, and this takes me back towards the point of fear and that end of the pendulum swing of saying, well, on the one hand, this is a fulfillment of our prophecies, and it's actually coming true, and the 70 years are at an end, and now we're going to return. And then on the other hand, oh my God, we're going to have to go there. This demands something of me. I have to make good on this messianic opportunity. I think that I think both reactions are reasonable reactions, and likely both exist, and that in part will contribute to the fact that, as you just said, there's a good chunk that don't return. We don't have really good numbers on this in terms of knowing what the total population was. But it's very clear that this is a small minority, and we see it in works like Zechariah, where we find out about the Jews who remain in Babel. But perhaps the best evidence that it's a very small minority that comes back is the Book of Esther, which I think I mentioned already once before, and I will likely mention again. You have a great story about the Jewish community of 127 lands, all based in Shushan. No one even mentions that there's a Jewish community back in the land of Israel. It's not even part of the conversation. Which I think tells you a great deal about the perception of the community that has returned. They're not the focal point. Susan.
If you look back at the story of the Jews when they were in Israel, they always seem to get in trouble, end up being, you know, enslaved, then get free, and maybe the people who were living in Persia, they didn't have any. They had a lot of good years there. And if there was a recollection of the past history, is there a possibility they could think, why should I go back? We always end up getting in trouble being in Israel. Here, my life's actually better than what my ancestors' lives were when they lived there.
Yeah. Well, no, Susan makes an important point, but I think that you have to ask a little bit of, much like the suspicion of the motivations, you know, question, we have to make sure that we don't retrofit our perspective on the perspective back then. Meaning, I have Tanakh laid out for me as a book. Right, I can flip page after page and see, and then they fought with Midian, and they were subdued by Midian for 7 years, and then they fought with Canaan, and Canaan was over them for 20 years. And I have the chronology all laid out for me. And as a kid, I learned, you know, that basically this is the arc of Jewish history, you know, with an emphasis on the downswing. So that's, you know, that's true from our perspective. And then looking at them living in Persia, and recognizing that the Persians seem to be relatively benign, you know, as despots go, makes me feel like, yeah, maybe they'd be more comfortable in fact, in the Persian exile. However, I think that it's important to try to put ourselves back in the mindset of the Jew who was exiled or whose parent was exiled, you know, at that point, and recognize that they saw themselves as displaced people. They didn't see themselves as, okay, now I'm a Jew living in Persia. That mindset, I think, comes from the fact that we've been a Jew living in X for a very long time. For them, they're an immediate, recently conquered people who have been, you know, kicked out. And it's not as though, for them, they can just embrace the idea of living in exile. I think it's a lot harder than we realize, because, again, it doesn't resonate the same way for us. I think the closest and most recent example in the Jewish world would be the people who were moved out of Gaza. Right? And I'm not going to go into disengagement in the debate. That's not the point. But the point is, you see the challenge for them to adjust. And they were moved into a Jewish land. They were moved into Jewish cities, into Israel itself. And yet, you see the challenge of adjusting. I think that's closer to the experience of the Jews who end up in Persia. Gita, and then.
You said talk about getting into their mindset. What do we have to believe that the Jews of Persia knew about what was going on at that moment?
What do you mean?
In terms of agriculture opportunities, what it was like there. We know, yeah, exactly. So people in more, in, you know, with modern communication know what's going on in Israel. Even in 48, people had some sense of it. But did they know what they're moving to?
Right, and the answer is they know that it's a ruin. Meaning they know that it was left desolate.
Okay.
And they know that they're going to encounter hostile neighbors.
Okay.
Because the Samaritans are there from before. Beyond that, I don't know what they know. Yes?
I'm thinking about the other Persian nations at the time. Are they, would they be thinking, because they're being asked to fund the return of the Jews, are they thinking, let's get them
up? Right, so that's a big question. It's a big question, and I don't have a good answer. In other words, we know that they will help, but we don't know what their motivation is in helping. Are they, you know, do they drink the Cyrus Kool-Aid and they believe that this is part of the fulfillment of their destiny? Or do they say, yeah, the sooner we get them out, the sooner we can take over their fields and no longer have the, you know, these pesky Jews living among us? Don't know. It's a good question. I've seen a lot of hands this way. So, all right, Dahlia first, and then I'll work my way around this way.
I just wanted to say that it goes to the whole question of what is the Jews' identity? Are we a nation? Are we a people? Are we a religion? Are we a philosophy? You know, and the people who saw us as a nation, I think, are the ones who went back, and so clearly that was the minority of the people. Most of the people who stayed in Babel, I don't think, saw themselves as part of a nation. They may have believed in a god, and they may have thought that they're the people of the book, but they may not have thought of themselves as a nation.
Would you accept that same analysis of Jews today who live outside of Israel?
Yes.
They not?
Yes.
That the that those who remain outside don't see themselves as a nation? I find that very hard to argue. I think there are so many reasons why people live where they live that have nothing to do with ideology.
I think that that's a very modern Orthodox parochial mindset, and I don't think that if you speak to 90% of the other Jews that they would be.
Okay, I'm cool with that. Yes? Susan?
Are these Jews in Babel first generation, like, did they pass, did some of them pass away, are they new people?
There's 70 years.
There are 70 years have passed. They are almost entirely born after. After the exile.
They have nothing to refer them to.
Other than the stories they heard from their parents. They heard things growing up. That's what they know. And there are some elders still around. That's very explicit in the story, as we'll see. But that's it.
So the strong yearning wouldn't be there if they weren't living
I don't think that's necessarily so. I think when you view yourself, again, as a displaced population, you don't necessarily forget after one generation. I'll give you another politically charged example. Just because you have to, I don't think you can ignore it, and that's Palestinian Arabs, right? A second, a third, and now a fourth generation that still insists this is our land and this is where we belong. And, you know, I'm not going anywhere in terms of the political comparison beyond that. But I think it's important to recognize that human beings do not simply say, well, I grew up in Persia, I guess I'm a Persian. It doesn't work that way. If you view yourself as an exiled population, that's going to affect the way you look at things. I'm going to go further now because otherwise we won't get to see any of Ezra. And I really did say we're going to finish the first chapter today. I heard it. It's on recording. But take a look at source number one. Source number one on your sheets comes from Rabbi Yosef Albo's work, Sefer HaYikarim. Rabbi Yosef Albo is a sage as well as philosopher living in, I believe it's 14th century Italy. I think he's 14th. He might be 15th, but I think he's 14th. The Sefer HaYikarim is a wonderful book, very worth reading. The opening part of it deals with the idea of fundamentals of faith. And I remember the first time I read this this book, and he completely turns the Rambam on his head. And I didn't know you could do that to him. But you did. But he did. He completely throws out the idea of the 13 Ikarim, 13 principles. He believes that there are principles, but he says many of the things that the Rambam considers essential and elemental to Judaism, such that if you don't believe it, you're a heretic, he says it's not true. They may be, it could be the Rambam is identifying things that are true, but it doesn't mean that it's a fundamental of faith. He says it's entirely possible for someone to be a believing Jew and simply be wrong about something. That doesn't make him a heretic. And it's a very interesting read. I highly recommend it. But that's not what we're talking about in it right now. If you take a look at what we have here in source number one, he's talking about these prophecies of redemption that are seen in Tanakh. And this will harken back to something that we saw in the book of Daniel when we learned Daniel 4 years ago here. He says, V'chein pirshuk tzaz ha-mefarshim shakol nevuo sav shal yeshaya niskaimu b'bayis sheni shetziva koresh livnos habayis. He says, some of the commentators similarly explain, similar to what he was said before this excerpt, that all of Yeshaya's prophecies, all of the visions of Isaiah, when he talks about what's going to be in the future, are fulfilled, not in a future messianic time, they're fulfilled in the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, because that's when Cyrus says to build it. That's the fulfillment of the vision. The Omrim Gamkein, if anyone doesn't have a sheet, I put them on the top of the bookcase with the Tanakh, so if anyone doesn't have a sheet, that's where you can get them. The Omrim Gamkein, Ki v'bayis sheni niskayim ve'viu es kol acheichem mikol agoyim en chal Hashem, the vision of Yeshaya, that all the nations are going to bring a gift to God? Yes, that happens. Right? Where do we see it? We see it when Cyrus gives the order that everybody should send gifts along with the Jews who are returning. So in other words, what Rabbi Alba was suggesting is that those prophecies that the Jews of the time are familiar with, they see as coming to fulfillment with Cyrus. This is it. You know, the big shofar has blown. There's someone riding a white donkey down the street. And I'm saying that figuratively. We don't find any white donkeys, white or otherwise, I think, actually, in the book of Ezra. The point is that to them, this is Mashiach. That's what it is. And I think that for many, it does have that hope, even as for some, including those who are hopeful, there will be the elements of fear as well. But along with this, it also reflects very poorly on our own leaders from the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, the end of the first temple. Meaning, here I have non-Jewish King Cyrus, worshipper of Ahura Mazda, right, who is issuing a decree to build the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. We recall the kings of the end of the first temple. Right, the ones for whom it's generally recorded in Tanakh, and he was as evil as, or, and he was more evil than all of his predecessors. Right, it's king after king after king who is described in that manner, with rare exception. And here comes this guy Cyrus, and he believes. He believes in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, and he agrees that we should read that we should rebuild the temple. You look at him and think, wow, you know, that's better than what we had. Yeah, let's elect Cyrus, essentially. And in fact, I think it does rub us the wrong way, and it classically has. And so we see various passages in the Midrash and in the Talmud which color texts, including Cyrus's own decree, and find ways to reduce and to mitigate the contrast between Cyrus and our own leaders. I give you an example. Take a look at source number two. Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah. That's on the list of kosher and non-kosher animals found in Parshat Shemini. So, one of the animals that's listed as being non-kosher is the shafan. Shafan we usually think of as a rabbit. But the problem is we also have the word arnevet that's used. So one is a rabbit and one is a hare, one is a coney. They come up with all these different terms, which I'm not expert enough zoologically to be able to tell you which one it actually is. But that's not the point for the purpose of this midrash. They quote the verse, Ve'et ha-shafan. And the midrash says, Zumadai. That refers to the nation of Media, the ones who allied with the Persians to defeat the Babylonians. Ki male geirahu, because the Persians and Medes, really, are male geirah. They, literally, male geirah is they chew their cud. right? The cud comes back up to be chewed. It elevates its cud, as I translated here. What does that mean? Shemekaleset l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, because it praises God, and they quote Cyrus's decree. So the Medrash says, Cyrus is like the Shafan, in the sense that Cyrus offers this positive decree that's like the rabbit, which has one kosher sign in that it, well, I should have introduced it this way, I suppose. There are two signs of a non-kosher animal, right? One is that it doesn't chew its cud, and the other is that it doesn't have split hooves. Its hooves are sealed. In the event that it has one of the kosher signs, it is not kosher. Right? Not less kosher, it is non-kosher. Right? It isn't that we don't have a three-part, you know, sort of system here. Kosher, a little kosher, and not kosher. No, it doesn't work that way. It is not kosher unless it has both signs. So the Shafan is described in the Torah as having one of the two signs. It chews its cud, but it doesn't have split feet, split hooves. So what this Medrash is trying to say is that, yeah, that's like Cyrus. He's good. He chews his cud, so to speak, in the sense that he has the, in the sense that he issues this decree, but Cyrus is still not kosher. And then the next one in the Medrash, the Arnevet, that's Yavan, that's Greece, because they also praise God, and it goes on to bring something relevant to Greece that's not germane for us right now. What this Medrash is doing is saying, yeah, Cyrus is half kosher. He has one kosher sign because he issued this decree. It's an attempt to say he's good, but he's not that good. We're going to come to see more of that actually later on in chapter 6 when we get the rest of Cyrus's decree and we read what the sages had to say about it. They even find fault in that decree. So that's worth considering. One other note that I couldn't resist bringing because it's a source that people usually misquote. So I figure let's quote it and let's discuss it a little bit just so that people know. One of the points that we noted in Cyrus's decree was he talked about building the temple of God that is in of the God of Jerusalem. Elokim asher b'Yerushalayim. Right? If you go back to the book itself, it's he said it twice as I recall.
Verse
right?
1:3
he says it, and then again in 1:4. I'm sorry, no, but I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at the, you're right, in 1:3. Ha'elokim asher b'Yerusha, he says, sorry, hang on. Right. No, but I'm looking at, no, I want for the end of verse 3. Right. Hu ha'elokim asher b'Yerushalayim. This is the God who is in Jerusalem. Thank you. So on the line, the God who is in Jerusalem, which makes it sound like God is still present in Jerusalem, he's describing God being there. He says, source number 3, this is a Midrash, Rabbi Eliezer says, Lo zaza hashchina mitoch ha'echal. God never left the temple. Shenamar v'hayu einai v'libi sham, because in fact, recorded in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles, God says, my eyes and heart will always be there in Jerusalem. See what Cyrus says. El ha'elokim asher b'Yerushalayim, to the God who was in Jerusalem, Amar la'en, he said to them, Av apishu charev, even though it is destroyed, ha'elokim eino zaz misham, God never leaves. God remains there. And then, Amar Rabbi Acha said, La'olam eina shechina zaza, mikotel ha'ma'aravi. The Shechina never leaves the western wall. Shenemar, and they quote the sentence in Shir HaShirim, Hinei Zeh Omed Achar Kotleinu, God is standing behind our wall. So this gets quoted all the time to say, see, that's why the western wall is still standing and God is still there at the western wall. Why is this incorrect as an association?
Because there was no western wall after the first. That's second.
Not because of that. No, it's still second. There have only been two, but you're on the right track. What is the western wall, the western wall of?
It's not the wall of the temple.
It's the wall of Har HaBayit, of the Temple Mount. It's the retaining wall. Right? When they expand that surface and they do this backfill into the area, then they put up retaining walls. It's the western wall of the Temple Mount. But as a kid, I was always taught, you know, God is behind the western wall. It was built by the paupers and the needy people as opposed to the other parts. You've heard that also? Right? God is there at the western wall. I'm not saying God is at the western wall. I'm saying this Medrash isn't about that. Okay. In any case, what we've seen then in this decree is Cyrus telling the Jews, the opportunity is there. You can come back. We're going to help you come back. And for some of them, this must feel like the realization of all of those prophecies. Yeshaya, Micha, Zechariah. Well, not Zechariah, because Zechariah hasn't spoken yet. But the fulfillment of these prophecies of the nations coming to recognize God. And others have to look at this, or the same people look at this and say, wow, is this frightening? Am I really going to go back and endanger everything that I have and everything that I've lived with in order to take the chance that I'm going to, that this is all going to actually work, that this is all going to succeed. A very challenging thing. And separately, Cyrus is a challenge in terms of what his righteousness says about the rest of our kings. With all that in mind, let's go further now and see what happens. Sentences 5 and 6. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1814. Vayakumu Rashei Ha'avos Lihuda Uvinyamin V'Hakohanim V'Halevim. The heads of the families of Yehuda, Binyamin, the Kohanim, and the Levites. L'chol he'ir ha'elokim esrucho. There's that phrase again. All whose spirit God had aroused. In other words, again, the idea that potentially, yes, God is inspiring them. This Ruach HaKodesh concept. La'alos livnos es beis Hashem Hashem Yerushalayim. To ascend, to build the house of God in Jerusalem. V'chol svivosehem chizeku videhem. And all those around them, meaning the neighbors, they all strengthened their hands, bichlei kodesh, bichlei kasef, I should say, sorry, with silver vessels, bazahav, with gold, baruchush, with property, uva behema, with animals, uva migdanos, and with delicacies, because, why not bring a little bit of, an eclair or something. Levad al kol hisnadev, aside from all that was volunteered. What questions do you have when you read these two verses? Yeah?
It's just the southern kingdom. It's just Yehuda
and... Just Yehuda and Binyamin. Just Yehuda and Binyamin. What happened to everybody? Well, also in Kohanim and Levium, right? The Kohanim because they get to work, and Levium because they have to wash their hands. What else? Where is everybody else?
Gone.
Gone, Ari says. What do you mean gone? You're right, but what do you mean?
Well, they've been disordered, or whatever, transferred. So many years before, and they've disappeared.
So one might give the answer, the Assyrians move out, the 10 tribes, the northern kingdom. However, it's not going to be so simple as we're going to see. But that's one question. Why Yehuda and Binyamin in particular? Other questions?
It seems that they do quite well for themselves if they can give them all the gold.
Those are the neighbors. Those are the non-Jewish neighbors who Cyrus ordered. Correct. Correct. Savivo Sehem, those who are around the Jews. Correct. That's usually, rechush is usually property, assets. What do they do in there?
Goods.
Okay. Goods are the same thing, no?
Property would be, what would the use of property be?
Property, I, when I say property, I mean belongings. I don't mean, I'm not talking land.
Oh, okay. Then.
Yeah, not real property, as the phrase goes. Yes, Elisheva.
So what's the additional volunteer effort?
Yeah, what do you mean, aside from the, I didn't think you left anything off the list, right? You have precious metals, you have rechush, goods, assets, belongings, property. You have animals, and you have a smorgasbord. So what else is being volunteered? Like, what was left off of the list? So, a couple of notes. First of all, Dan Mikra notes, and I think it's a valid point, that in sentence 5, we talk about them based on their tribes. That's not so simple and straightforward that they would have kept their tribal identity. Once you're exiled to Babylon, what use is your tribal identity? Why do I care that I'm from Binyamin, that I'm from Yehuda? What does it say about them if they retain their tribal identity?
It's more absorbed into the population.
Well, it's that just, being Jewish. I think it's saying something else, yeah?
Portion of land in Israel.
Right. Meaning, they expect to go home and to reclaim their property. Each tribe has its tribal portion, and we are going to reclaim our portion when we come home. We're going back to our land, which is a major question. I noted last week, Cyrus did not deal with this question at all. Right? Cyrus may be a big picture man. He doesn't really deal with that. But, they're going to come back, and someone else is going to be in their land. Now what? Who's gonna get that land? But I think that is part of them retaining their identity. But now Yehuda and Binyamin, Judah and Benjamin in particular, are the ones who return. So what's that about? Take a look, please. Actually, no, don't take a look yet. I didn't bring it. I thought I wrote it on the sheet. But Ibn Ezra says, you know why it's Yehuda and Binyamin? Because Jerusalem is in their portion. When the land is divided up in Yehoshua, Binyamin and Yehuda are adjacent to each other, Yehuda to the south, Binyamin to the north, and then there's a debate in the Talmud as to whether Yerushalayim itself was divided between them, or whether it was actually sort of a no man's land that's owned by the nation as a whole. But either way, those are the two logical tribes. If you're talking about going back to Jerusalem that is in Judea, yep, that's us. So it's time for them to go. However, the truth of the matter is that it's not necessarily just them. The Medrash in Seder Olam notes that even though, as Laurie mentioned before, we're going to find out that 42,000 and change Jews come back. I think it's 42,360. When we actually count up the census, where we're going to say these came back and there were 150 of them, and these came back and there were X number of them, it's not going to add up. Yeah, in Chumash, the numbers tend to add up, and we get very upset if the numbers don't add up. Well, in Ezra, the numbers won't add up to 42,000 and change. So take a look at what this Medrash says. So that's number 4. Ubifrat einan ela shloshim elef u'shlosh meos v'shishim. The truth of the matter is, it's going to be 30,360 out of the numbers that we're going to see. U'shnemesar elef heichanim. So where's the other 12,000? To which the answer is, ela elusha alu mishara shvatim. The answer is, we only count the Yehuda and Binyamin ones. Those are the dominant ones. And the others were stragglers from the other Shvatim, from the other tribes. In other words, it wasn't just Yehuda, Binyamin, and Kohen Levi returning, but other Shvatim, other tribes, returned as well. Now you'll say, well, what happened? I thought they went into exile. Weren't they exiled by the Assyrians? The truth of the matter is that it's fairly clear, according to most commentators, that you find some element of them either never were exiled, in other words, the Assyrians did not succeed in exiling everybody, or alternatively, some of them came back. Now, there's actually a Gemara that talks about all of them coming back under King Yoshiyahu, that Yirmiyah brings them back, and you know all those stories that I heard as a kid about the Sambatyon and all of the different ethnic groups around the world who are associated with Jews, and we like to say that they may be from the 10 lost tribes. No, sorry, they're just Jewish. They're not from Dun or whatever it is. They're not. You know, it adds this kind of romantic element to it when you say that it's from a lost tribe, but not necessarily. Take a look at source number 5. What Radak says in Malachim Beis, Kings 2. His challenge is that he's dealing with a discussion of Kutim and Jews living in Shomron, and he says, the Kutim are living up in Samaria. The Jews aren't in Shomron. The answer is that these altars remained in this area. You have to look in Malachim Ben in Kings 2 to see the context for the altars. It's not germane for us. And he says a remnant of Jews remained even after the northern kingdom was exiled. They were scattered in the land here and there. And they still worshipped idols. And he says, it's also in Chronicles, and I gave you the reference in the English, Chronicles 2, chapter 30, sentence 18, we'll say it explicitly, or it seems to be explicit, that Ephraim and Menashe were there in the days of King Yoshiyahu in the first temple. And in the days of Chizkiyahu you had a remnant, Mizvulun, Asher, Shimon, Ephraim, Menashe. And then he goes on to quote the Medrash about Yirmiyahu bringing the tribes back. The point is that Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, offers us multiple options to explain that ultimately there were other tribes there who were from the 10, there were other Jews there from the 10 tribes. Whether it's because the Assyrians were not as efficient as they thought they were, or whether it's because they came back, no one can say. But fundamentally, we find verses in Tanakh after the Assyrians have exiled the northern kingdom that mention these tribes in the land. And so, when our verse says Yehuda and Binyamin came back, they were the central ones, which, as Ibn Ezra notes, makes sense because Jerusalem is theirs. However, they weren't the only ones. There were others who came back as well. That whole Yehuda Binyamin thing is a very interesting relationship in its own right. We're not going to talk about this in depth now, but I just call your attention to it because it's fascinating. The interplay of Yehuda and Binyamin in Tanakh. Where does that relationship begin? Before. It was a pretty good guess, say the Joseph story, but it's actually before. Who is Yehuda's mother? Right, with their mothers, good. Yehuda's mother is Leah, Binyamin's mother is Rachel. So that opposition between Rachel and Leah is actually the start of this. Yehuda and Binyamin in the Joseph story, in that Binyamin goes down to Egypt only when Yehuda guarantees and says, I am going to be responsible for his safety. Binyamin then is held by the king for this alleged theft, and who is the one who bails him out? Yehuda going to Yosef. And you can track this further in Tanakh. Best example, who's the first king in Israel?
Shaul.
Who's the second one? David, right? I mean, Ishbosheth, you can have a conversation about Ishbosheth. But David is essentially the one who supplants Shaul. Shaul is from Binyamin. David is from Yehuda. There's this whole back and forth down the line in Jewish history with Yehuda and Binyamin, and they happen to be the two controllers of Yerushalayim and the leaders of the return back to the land here. Okay, so Yehuda, Binyamin, and others return to the land, and then in sentence 6, we said that their neighbors give them all sorts of stuff. Livad al kol hisnadev, aside from all that is volunteered, right? Besides all that was contributed, they cheated. The art scroll added 3 words. Aside from all that was contributed for the Beis Hamikdash. Where did they get that idea from?
It's not in JPS.
It's not in the JPS. It must be made up. No.
It is.
Where did they get that from? It's actually in the text. You just have to figure it out. No, sorry?
In Dalit it says
what? Good. In other words, in Dalit, in sentence 4, Cyrus's decree said that when people are going back, their neighbors should elevate them with silver, gold, property, goods, whatever, and animals, along with the gift that's going to be for the house of God in Jerusalem. This is exactly parallel. That's what's going on in sentence 6, is that that's the hit nadev, what they give for that. And not only that, it's very clear in sentence 6 itself, because it says they strengthen the hands of those who are coming back, who we listed in 5, along with what they donate for the temple, for the Beis HaMikdash. I think that's a clear read. Mitzvah David takes that read as well. Rashi does note one other possibility, which is that the former items are from the neighbors, but Hit Nadev is what the Olim bring. But I Mitzvah David's read seems very clear here. Yes, Elisheva.
In the previous parshas, when it relates to the building of Mishkan, doesn't it also use that word,
correct? Nidava is the big word. Nidava is the big word. It suggests indeed volunteering, and it is the word for the building of the Mishkan. So you're seeing a parallel here in terms of the Mishkan. Good. Okay. So Cyrus now acts. We're up to sentence 7. V'amelech Koresh hotzias klei beis Hashem asher hotzin Nebuchadnezzar miYerushalayim v'yit name beveis Elohav. I'm at sentence 7. Yep, still sentence 7. It's page 1814 in the Sefer Tanakh. Yeah, sorry, not number 7. Sentence 7. So King Cyrus takes out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem and Nebuchadnezzar had placed in the house of his idols. Vayotziyem Koresh Melech Paras Ayadei Misridas or Mitridat HaGizbar. And Cyrus takes them via Mithridates, the Gizbar, the person who is in charge, Mithridates perhaps. Vayisperem l'shesh batzar anasi liyuda, and he gives them to shesh batzar to be responsible for them. As they translate vayisperem here, as he counted them over, meaning there's actually an accounting, right? Imagine the Jews go into exile, and like when someone goes to jail, so they enumerate all his goods and they put it in the locker. So okay, check, check, check. We've got all the items. And ve'ela misparam, sentence 9. Here is the list. Agartale Zahav Shloshim. 30 Agartale Zahav. What is an Agartal in modern Hebrew?
A vase.
A vase, right. A vase or a vase is an Agartal. Where does the word come from? I mean, obviously the word comes from Ezra. But where does it, what's the etymology of the word?
Agar is a collection, like water.
So I always thought it was exactly what Gita is suggesting now, and I still think it's a great explanation, which is agar, tal. Agar is to store. It's what you store dew in. You store moisture in it. However, in truth, Susan is correct. It's actually...
Down here it says Greek.
Oh, Susan's book is correct.
I didn't look at it first. Yes, Greek, but then I looked at it.
Okay, so the answer is that there is indeed a word, kartala. And agartal is kartala. It means a receptacle. That's the origin of the word. That mikra traces it to an Aramaic word, actually, kartala. He has kartal or kartala or kartalita. Okay.
It also says that the anthology of Arabic, Syriac, and Ethiopiac are translated as baskets, and the Septuagint just translates it as wine coolers.
Okay, wine coolers. Excellent. Gold wine coolers for the trip. The look, if you're going, you got to go in style. So Agartalei Zahav Shloshim, but only 30 of them for 42,000 people. They're going to get thirsty. Agartalei Kesef Alef. The answer is they have 1,000 more made of silver. That's what people are actually drinking out of. They're not drinking any of them because these are property of the temple. Machlafim Tish'a Ve'esrim. That's another very interesting word. Machlafim. 29 machlafim. What are machlafim? So they render it here. I hope they say knives. Where is it? Yes, they say slaughtering knives. Anybody know how you say a shochet's knife?
Chalaf.
Chalaf, right. Chalaf, as they usually say. But that's... from this word. That's where they're getting it. It's not only here, it's found in Tanakh in general, but that's indeed the word machlafim. Kiforei zahav shloshim. 30 kiforei zahav. So they're made of gold. What are these? These are the vessels that are used in order to catch the blood from the carbon. The word lechaper, which we usually render as to atone, means to wipe, like wiping a liquid off of one's hand.
It's 30 and 30.
Kforei chesef mishnim, arba meyos va'asara, silver kforim of silver, and the word mishnim is a word I want to come back to. There are 410 of these. Kelim achirim alef, and then 1,000 assorted vessels. Kol kelim lazav v'la kesef chameshes alafim v'arba meos. All of the silver and gold vessels, in total 5,400. Hakol he'ala shesh batzar im he'alos hagolam mibavel Yerushalayim, and shesh batzar brought them with the Jews who came back from Babel to Jerusalem. That's our chapter. We obviously, though, are not done, because we need to understand sentences 7 to 11. What questions does this passage here raise for you?
Where the most precious
vessels? Sorry, was Susan first?
I don't know why every single thing had to be named.
Why do I have a list like this? That's good. That's one question. Rabbi Osterker asks, where's the Aron? Where's the menorah? Right? I mean, it's nice to have all the vessels for holding the blood from the carbon, but seriously, how about the shulchan, the table that the showbread sits on? Where's that in the Vatican? No, where are these things? We don't have any mention of any scrolls being returned. We just have these vessels that are listed here.
But that doesn't equal 5,400, so there are at all. There's others.
This number, I didn't add them up.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. Sorry?
It's a list of small change
relative to what's missing, right. Yeah. Not to mention, who is Shesh Batzar? Where did he come from? You can ask that, Joyce. Yeah, who's Shesh Batzar? Why don't I know anything about this very interesting person? I mean, he's the leader of Judea, and he's given the temple vessels to look for. I would think you'd know something about him, but you just hire him without a resume? What is he? So let's take a look at this. First of all, again, the return of the vessels, which I emphasized so much in our first couple of weeks, is the completion of the arc of this trip that began with the vision of Yirmiyahu and the idea that the vessels will be taken into exile along with us. I should also note, because I haven't mentioned it until now, there's a pasuk in which Hashem says, "Shulachti bavela lemanchem." I have been sent into exile for you. And there's a medrash on that. It's an obscure medrash. There's a medrash that suggests Hashem says, "I was sent to Bavel," meaning I sent myself into exile along with you. And the goal of doing so is so that you will be worth redeeming. In other words, now there's a reason to redeem you because I am in exile as well. So that for those who say carefully the Hoshanos, you know that there's this line, Nakuva v'hutseisi itchem. Instead of v'hutseisi eschem, I will take you out. V'hutseisi itchem, I will be taken out along with you. And on that, the Medrash gives you an example. It gives you a parable. It says, imagine that somebody has an item that he lost. He lost, I'll put it into our own parlance. Somebody lost a loonie, or somebody lost a $10 bill. So, it matters to him, and he goes looking for it, but he can't find it. So, he wants other people to help him. So what does he do? He takes his gold ring, or takes a $100 bill, and drops that, and says, I lost a $100 bill. And now suddenly people will come around and they'll help them search. So Hashem says, I'm in exile with you as well to raise the stakes, so to speak, for the return. And I think what that Medrash is actually referring to, I haven't seen anyone say it, but I think so, is the loss of the vessels of the temple. That's the idea that God is sent into exile. It's the temple vessels that are being sent with him. Okay. So the vessels are coming home, and then Mithridat is somebody who is in charge of that. So the name Mithridat, in case you wanted to know, means gift of Mithra. That's actually what it means. It may have been a common name. Another Mithridat is going to show up in chapter 4. He's a different Mithridat. He's among the enemies of the Jews who are building the Beis HaMikdash. So he's somebody else entirely. But the name may have been a common name among the Persians. But more to the point, Shesh Batzar. So Shesh Batzar is strange. Not personally, but he's strange in the sense that we find him mentioned here as the leader of Judea, which is a serious political position. On the other hand, when we read the other books of the time, Haggai and Zechariah, no one mentions Shesh Batzar. Whereas Zerubbabel, who we're going to find as a leader of Judea in another couple of chapters, is mentioned in Haggai and is mentioned in Zechariah. So who is this guy, Shesh Batzar? What is he doing here?
Same guy,
meaning that Zerubbabel is Shesh Batzar. So I'm going to come back to that idea. We will get Shesh Batzar listed here. The other place Shesh Batzar is going to show up will be in chapter 6, where he will be credited with laying the foundations of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, and bringing back the vessels, as he does here. He is named here as Nasi Yehuda, the leader of Judea. In chapter 5, he will also get the title Pecha. What is Pecha?
Pasha.
Pasha, right, the governor. Which is actually difficult because Judea at this point doesn't have its own governor. It's part of a much larger region nonetheless. So who is he? So Ibn Ezra is of the view, as Ari suggests, that Zerubbabel and Shesh Batzar are the same person. Well, that solves my problem of where he went. They're the same person. He says, I have two proofs for you. Take a look at source number 6. The Hebrew's at the bottom of one side. The English is the top of the other side. V'sheish batzar hu Zerubbabel v'lo Daniel. He says, Shesh batzar is Zerubbabel. Daniel is not Zerubbabel. Daniel is not Shesh batzar. Daniel's a different person. He comments that way because there are others who associate Daniel with Zerubbabel. So he says, Shesh batzar is Zerubbabel. Daniel is not. V'shtei rayo says, I have two proofs. One, Sh'amar al Zerubbabel pachas Yehuda, v'yilo l'sheish batzar shmei ki pecha shmei. We know that Zerubbabel is called the pecha, and Shesh Batzar is. That's one proof. V'raya acheres gedola v'chazaka mizos, and I have a better and stronger piece of evidence. Sha'amar Zechariah yedezru bavel yastu abayit hazeh. Because Zechariah says, regarding the Beis HaMikdash, the hands of Zerubbabel lay the foundations of this house. Whereas in Ezra, it's going to say in chapter 5, I said 6 before, but I should have said 5, that it's Shesh Batzar who is responsible for laying the foundations. So even Ezra says, clearly, Zerubbabel and Shesh Batzar are just two names for the same person. Maybe one name is a Babylonian name, and one name is a Jewish name. The others do not necessarily accept this. First of all, Encyclopedia Mikra'it points out that both the names Shesh Batzar and Zerubbabel are Babylonian names. By the way, others are going to identify Zerubbabel with Nehemiah, so that will be even more fun when we get to chapter 2. But well, the line between Babylonian and Persian in that society is going to be blurred, because the Persians take over Babylon, but have only been there for a couple of decades. Or actually not even, they've just got there now. This is Cyrus's first year in control. So basically these are Babylonian names as far as anyone's going to be concerned. The other approach that I've seen is that Shesh Batzar is somebody by the name of Shen Atzar. If you take a look at, skip the problem I identified in source number 7, I'm not going to go through that right now, but take a look at Chronicles 1:3-18. This is 1880. Among a list of names.
Hold on.
Really go back to sentence 17, I suppose. Okay? Page 1880. It lists the sons of somebody by the name of Yechoniah. Who is Yechoniah? Who was Yechoniah? We learned about him a few weeks ago. Right, one of the last kings before the temple was destroyed. So he has sons who are, going starting from sentence 17, Asir, Shaaltiel, Malkiram, Fedaya, Shenatzar, Yekamya, Hoshama, and Nadavia. So some suggest that Shesh Batzar is Shenatzar, that they're the same person. Remembering that this is not a society in which everything goes into writing, and therefore names can in fact shift like that. And the critics and scholars actually accept this idea that it's Shenatzar. What's the value of saying it's Shenatzar? That he is Shesh Batzar? Davidic line. And not just Davidic line, but like recent king line. Meaning, I want to know, why did Cyrus pick this man as the one who's going to bring back the vessels and be the Nasi, be the leader of the Jews in Judea? Well, the answer is, he's from the last royal family we knew. He's a son of King Yechoniah, so it actually makes a lot of sense. So what we're seeing here, so far in this section about the execution of the decree, is that the kalim, the vessels, are coming back. They're coming back in the hands of Shesh Batzar, who may have a royal pedigree. And then we get our list. So we already said the Agartal from Kartalita is some kind of vessel for storing liquid. The Machlavot, the knives. And then the question, which I think Dahlia pointed out last time, of, so then how did Ahasuerus get vessels to drink from? Where did he get those from? It used the word Mishnim, which I thought was a nice association with Kelim Mikelim Shonim in Megillat Esther, and the Talmud has other ways to support the connection with the vessels of Ahasuerus. But we do need to understand, if this is really true, where did Ahasuerus get them? And is the Talmud ignorant of the book of Ezra, that it doesn't know that they were back already? That's a very hard thing to say, given the way that they quote the book of Ezra all over the place. So the only answers that I can offer are that either they were returned in multiple batches. That would be one approach. In other words, this is the first batch to come back, but that others will go later when Ezra goes. Or, alternatively, when the decree comes to stop them from building the temple, maybe they're actually summoned back. Like, we don't want you building the temple anymore, we're putting a halt to it, we're reclaiming the vessels that we sent for the temple. The first approach would go well with the fact that we notice there's stuff missing from the list. So maybe some things had not been sent back. But the list is indeed missing our own shulchan, menorah, like key things, which may be a contributing factor in the observation in the Talmud that we don't get all the major original vessels back for the second Beis HaMikdash. So the second Beis HaMikdash is missing things that were in the first.
I was going to ask you, did we know that it's the same stuff?
Right, so the answer is we know that some of it is not. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But it says here that Sheish Butzar is a Babylonian name coming from Shemash. Well, Usar, and that was the sun god, protecting the sun. So,
well, you're working with the same book. Yeah. Right, so that's one association that's brought. Others give other associations, because there are different ways that you can parse these words. But yes, the idea that it's a Babylonian name is certainly found in the among various scholars.
And so was Mordechai. So
right.
Right. John and Mark and wherever.
Right, but we're still on Sheish Butzar. The let's you know, dialet Sar Bishaita. Let's deal with the we have on our plate. So to summarize what we have here in chapter one. Number one, Cyrus's decree. We did complete the chapter. Cyrus's decree, which may not have been an expression of loyalty to the Jewish God as much as just using political speech, but the language in the text here indicates a belief that God is involved in awakening him to do this. The call for the nations to support our return is like when we left Egypt. The Sheish Butzar receives the vessels and leads the return. One other question, though, that I just want to deal with quickly. Where's Ezra? If Ezra is so righteous, and we're going to see that he is, why didn't he go? Why is it he's not going to show up until chapter 7? Where is he? So the sages are clearly bothered by this, and they offer a very intriguing answer which has all sorts of ramifications, which I'm going to use for the last minute of our class so we won't get to discuss the ramifications. Take a look at source number 9. We're going to have to deal with this at some point, though. Source number 9. Gadol Talmud Torah Yoser Mibinyan Beis HaMikdash, says the Talmud. Torah study is greater than building the temple. Shekolzman Shebaruch Ben Neria Kayam Lo Hinicho Ezra Ve'Allah. As long as Baruch Ben Neria lived, Ezra did not abandon him to ascend. What are we talking about? Who was Baruch Ben Neria? No, but who was Baruch Ben Neria? I'm sorry?
A Talmud.
Before Ezra ever came on the scene. He was?
Didn't he help out one of the
He was the scribe of Yirmiyahu. He is the scribe of Yirmiyahu. And he is the teacher of Ezra, as recorded here in the Talmud. And as long as he lives, Ezra is not interested in leaving Bavel. But that's a very important point. And the reason I say this has many ramifications is because what Baruch ben Neria really means for everything in Jewish history, going back to then, is he is the link in the chain. In other words, there will be a constant debate, which we are going to have to get to, of how much of what Ezra did was a continuation of the past, and how much of what Ezra did is new. Whatever he has that's from the past is coming to him via Baruch ben Neria, the student of Jeremiah, the student of Yirmiyahu. And he's not willing to leave as long as he's able to absorb more from Baruch ben Neria. Only once Baruch dies is Ezra going to make the journey. There's a lot more to say about this, obviously. We are going to have to come back to this point, but I didn't want to end the chapter without noting the absence of the person for whom the book is named. So God willing, we'll pick up with chapter 2 next week and the name lists. Thank you very much.